Merci d'être venu à Giselle's Books pour a reading party. C'est le reading party pour les rééditions du Top Stories qui était édité par Anne Turin dans les années. Ça a commencé dans les années 1968 jusqu'au 91. Et c'est une série du, on peut dire, chapbooks ou fanzines qui était édité par Anne Turin à Buffalo, New York, et à New York City. Et elle a invité plein de femmes à écrire les histoires, la poésie et autres propositions. Et c'était publié d'une manière un peu expérimentale et punk. Et c'est Primary Information, une maison d'édition basée à New York, qui a réédité. Et on a deux volumes 7 maintenant ici. Et pour cette journée-là, je voulais inviter les voix contemporaines dans la scène marseillaise à lire un peu des histoires dans Top Stories. Et c'est aussi l'occasion de montrer une expo du Anne Turin, qui a fait les photographies pour les Top Stories de Kathy Acker. Je crois que c'est numéro 9 dans les éditions pour l'histoire New York City en 1978-1981. Donc, toutes les photos dans les murs là sont les originaux du 81. Fait par Anne Turin à New York. Et elle me dit qu'elle voulait que les rééditions du Top Story c'est une sorte d'anthologie pour une génération d'écrivains maintenant, d'écriture expérimentale. Parce qu'elle, elle avait une édition qui s'appelle Breakthrough Fictioneers. Quand elle avait, je crois, 20 ans, quand elle était étudiante. Et elle me dit que c'était 90% l'écriture par les hommes dans Breakthrough Fictioneers. Donc, elle est heureuse qu'on utilise les volumes-là comme une anthologie actuelle pour l'usage quotidien. Pardon, j'ai perdu. Mais en tout cas, merci à toutes et tous pour être ici et pour les voir. Pour lire les histoires. Merci à Elia, David, pour les climats soniques. Merci à Lucas et Ryder à Giselle's Books pour accueillir les super événements. Et on commence avec Félix et Pap avec une histoire de Laurie Anderson. Merci.
Words in reverse. The following texts are extracts from Like a Stream, 1978, a piece for string ensemble, tape bow instruments and voice, and Americans on the Move, 1979, an extended series for voice, electronics, film, and instruments. It was the night flight from Houston, almost perfect visibility. You could see the lights from all the little Texas towns far below. I was sitting next to a 52-year-old woman who had never been on a plane before. Her son had sent her a ticket and said, "Mom, you've raised 10 kids. It's time you got on a plane." She was sitting in the window seat, staring out. She kept talking about the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper and pointing. Suddenly, I realized she thought we were in outer space, looking down at the stars. I said, "You know, I think those lights down there are the lights from little towns." I saw a photograph of Tesla, who invented the Tesla coil. He also invented a pair of shoes with soles 4 inches thick to ground him while he worked in the laboratory. In the picture, Tesla was sitting in his lab, wearing the shoes, and reading a book by the light of the long streamer-like sparks shooting out of his transformers. I went to the movies and I saw a dog 30 feet high. And this dog was made entirely of light. And he filled up the whole screen. And his eyes were long hallways. He had those long, echoing hallway eyes. He thought of space that way, as something you could fall into, falling for miles sideways. I met a man in Canada, and every day he had the same thing for lunch. He had a carrot, and he had a bowl of chocolate pudding. First, he ate the carrot into the shape of a spoon, and then he ate the pudding with the carrot-shaped spoon. And then he ate the carrot. There are Eskimos who live above the timberline. There's no wood there for the runners of the sleds. So instead they use long frozen fish, which they strap on the bottoms of their sleds to slip across the snow. It was a room full of people. They had all arrived at the same building at approximately the same time. They were all free, and they were all asking themselves the same question. What is behind that curtain? Peter says the thing he likes best about bowling is that you can see exactly what shoe sizes people wear. No one has ever looked at me like this for so long. No one has ever stared at me like this for such a long time. This is the first time anyone has ever looked at me like this, stared at me like this for such a long time, for so long, for such a long time. Oh, I like the way you look. Oh, I like the way you talk. Oh, I like the way you walk. But most of all, I like the way you look at me. I can draw you so that you have no ears. I can draw you so that you have no ears at all. So that where your ears would be, there is only blank paper. I am, in my body, the way most people drive in their cars. I went to a poem reader, and the odd thing about the reading was that everything she told me was totally wrong. But she seemed so sure of the information that I began to feel like I'd been walking around with these false documents permanently tattooed to my hands. It was very noisy in the parlor, and members of her family kept running in and out. They were speaking a high, clicking kind of language that sounded a lot like Arabic. Books and magazines in Arabic were strewn all over the floor. It suddenly occurred to me that maybe there was a translation problem, that maybe she was reading my hand from right to left instead of left to right. Thinking of mirrors, I gave her my other hand. Then she put her hand out, and we sat there for several minutes in what I assumed was some sort of participatory ritual. Finally, I realized that her hand was out because she was waiting for money. You know, you look a lot like a car. From a distance, say from a few blocks away, you look exactly like a car. You look like a car from a distance. Dad said last spring there were a lot of geese in his wheat field. The geese grew, and the wheat grew. The geese grew, and the wheat kept growing. But the geese always grew just slightly faster than the wheat, and all you could see were their long necks waving above the fields of grain. And he said, look, they look like cobras out there in that wild field. If you can't talk about it, point to it. I met a writer at a cocktail party. This writer used I in all his books. He was famous for the way he used I in all the books he wrote. At the party, people kept coming up to him and saying, gee, I really like your work. And he kept saying, thanks, but I'm not very representative of myself. Well, I know you. I know who you are, baby. I watched you count yourself to sleep. You're the shepherd, baby, and you are also 1 to 300 sheep. I've watched you fall asleep.
Hey, I'm just gonna have to find my spot. I'm a little bit, and it's hard to follow Felix with such a great reading and amazing text as well. Can you hear me okay? Cool. So, Living with Contradictions by Lynn Tillman, with drawings by Jane Dickerson. He didn't want to fight in any war, and she didn't want to have a child. They'd been living together for 3 years, and they still didn't have a way to refer to each other. They didn't sound stupid, false, or antiquated. Language follows change, and there wasn't any language to use. Partners in a pair bonded situation. That sounded like neutral. Of course, living with someone isn't a neutral situation. Judy and Joe aren't cave dwellers. They don't live together as lovers or as husband and wife. How long would this century be called modern or even postmodern? Perhaps relationships between people in the 14th century were more equitable, less fantastic. Not that Julie would have wanted to be the miller's wife, or Joe the miller. In other centuries, different relationships, less presumption, less intimacy. Before capitalism, early capitalism, no capitalism, feudalism, feudal relationships. I want one of those, Julie thought, something feudal. What would it be like to not have a contemporary mind? So we have him on the phone and her smoking a cigarette. Intimacy is something people used to talk about before commercials. Now there's nothing to say. People are intimate with their analysts, if they're lucky. What could be more intimate than an advertisement for Ivory soap? It's impossible not to be affected. The manufacture of desire and the evidence of real desire. But real desire for what? For what is real and what is manufactured? Other people's passions always leave you cold, and there is nothing like really being held. They didn't expect to be everything to each other. And you have them lying in bed, kind of spooning with a little cat, and then not spooning, that little moment where you separate when you've been asleep and you wake up and you're not spooning anymore with the cat. The first year they lived together was a battle to be together and also to be separate, a silent battle, because you can't fight the fight together. It defeats the purpose of the battle. You can't talk about relationships. Well, at least they didn't. They talked about things that happened and things that didn't. Daily life is very daily. There's some daily life. The great adventure, the pioneering thing, is to live together and not to be a couple. The expectation is indefatigable and exhausting. Julie bought an Italian postcard, circa 1953, showing an ardent man and woman locked in embrace and looking at each other, except that one of her eyes roved outwards, the other in, and his eyes were both looking at her but crossed. Like star-crossed lovers' eyes should be, she thought. She drew a triangle around their eyes, which made them still more distorted. People would ask, where's Joe? As if there was something supposed to be attached to her, but the attachment, my dear, isn't tangible, she wanted to say, but it is also physical. New cars, new lovers. Sometimes she felt like Mark Kettle in a situation comedy, looked on from the inside or from the outside. You're either on the inside looking out or you're on the outside looking in. Then there's the inside looking in and the outside looking out. Joe says, we're old love. Julie says, we're familiar with each other. Julie didn't mind, except she didn't have anyone new to talk about the way her friends did. Consumerism is love. One friend told her, talking about the person you lived with was like airing your clean laundry in public. Like taking out the trash and drinking coffee in the morning. Familiarity was for her better than romance. She'd been in love enough. Being in love is a fiction that lasts an hour and a half, feature length, and then you're hungry again. Unromantic old love comforted her like a room to read in. Joe says, you hooked up with me at the end of your hard guy period. Julie says, how do you know? Joe says, oh, I know. So Julie and Joe were just part of the great heterosexual capitalist family thrall, possessing each other. Contradictions make life finer. Ambivalence is just another word for love. Becoming romantic about the unconscious. Where does one find comfort? Even constancy. To find it in an idea or in the flesh, we do incorporate ideas, after all. You can accept the irrational over and over again. You can renounce your feelings every day, but you're still a baby. An infant outside of reason, speaking reasonably about the unreasonable. I don't know what this one is of, but I think it's nice. Calling love desire doesn't change the need. Julie couldn't abandon her desire for love. It was a pleasurable contradiction, and it was against all reason. Cool. Thank you.
I'm reading several short stories by Lee Eferman. The first is called Painting Houses. Every day he hooks his ladder onto the roof of his station wagon, stops off for a coffee to go, and begins his working day by unhooking the ladder from the roof of his car. At lunchtime, he drinks a tall boy beer along with his sandwich. He is always on the lookout for a reliable partner, someone who is willing to do the trim work as well as the higher spots. He prefers working in the fall, but naturally he does the bulk of his work in the summer. The first thing his clients want to know is if he is in any relation to the governor. He used to turn down those jobs. Crime. Crime is fascinating to think or read about, especially if you're not a criminal yourself. Knowing criminals is not glamorous. Generally, they should be fairly bright or else their career is doomed to be a short one. Besides, it provides a reasonable excuse for telling a story. This thing happened. Crime is concrete. There is nothing vague about having your Walkman stolen. Or on the other hand, suddenly owning a Walkman. Or a ladder. Say the kind house painters use. Dyeing your hair blonde. It's summer, and all the kids are on the beach drinking beer, smoking pot, eating acid, and watching for the perfect wave. A few summers back, Donna thought hanging out at the beach was more fun. Maybe it's because, as her mother insists, she's finally outgrowing juvenile activities that go nowhere. Or maybe it's because everyone has switched from the big disco radios to the Walkman. It's hard to party when everyone is dancing to their own beat. Donna thinks her old boyfriend Joey must be doing too many drugs lately, or else he's drinking. Why would his girlfriend be trying so hard to reform him? Unless he really is a sad case. All of Donna's girlfriends agree with her. The rain. 4 days of rain puts everyone in a funk. All activities seemed to grind to a halt. Donna and her friends had to go to summer school. The beach was definitely a drag in the rain. And outdoor service jobs stopped until the weather changed again. The park employees stopped cleaning the grounds of the park. No one went to the car wash and house painters stayed home and watched TV. Joey was bored at home. He had a rotten home life. His new girlfriend was out of town and his mother was off traveling with some new boyfriend. Joey was itching to shatter the boring slump of his summer. To kidnap a smart girl and hold her for ransom, that was his latest plan for earning some money. All he needed was a smart girl who was willing and a ladder to kidnap her with. Secret stains. She wants to fold the towels first when they come out of the dryer. They're so inviting, warm and fluffy, just the way her husband would like her to be, preferably with another woman while he's watching. Twice this past week, he's suggested the possibility of planning a weekly fling with some other couples he knows. He introduced this idea slowly weeks ago over a bottle of brandy. It must be the kind of trait that emerges in a man in his 30s. When she first met him, there was no sign of him going weird like that. There's a photograph of him in the living room. It's propped up on the left speaker, capturing him as he was when she first met him. She was impressed then by his thick, bushy, jet black moustache. He had just completed his second major deal. Cocaine then was like handling heroin, he explained to her. Taboo, but thrilling. He felt lucky to be alive. Then his picture was taken. Next, she sorts the piles of underwears into his and hers. The clothes have been sitting in the dryer for hours. She has avoided this chore all day. In the dryer, there is further evidence of Alex's infidelities. As she spots the blue lace underwear, the phone starts ringing in the background. Alex's clientele seem to be exclusively women these days. She knows that once she leaves Alex, there will be no more conveniences like dryers for a long time to come. Suspended between the lacy evidence and the phone ringing, she's tempted to just light up a joint and watch the tensions float away. The weight of a pink vase. She stopped every day at the window of this one antique shop. In the middle of a window, surrounded by bits of lace and old world remainders, stood a beautiful, milky, translucent pink vase. In the vase, there was a rotating display of budding branches, bright tulips and withering wildflowers. She frequently thought about her ideal home of the future. With their bright child, she and her husband would settle in for a hushed evening while the world gathered in around them. For some reason, this pink vase figured in her plans. It served as a linchpin of her happy future arrangement. With a tremendous release of tension, she realized she was no longer battling time. Once she stopped and pointed the vase out to Mark, she shared with him this secret image attached to the vase. Mark was visibly not moved by this idea. He had heard it before, usually about 2 months into any new relationship. Why was it that the nurturing wellspring of his lovers seemed to speak of so vividly never called to him? Eventually, it was clear to him that despite their mutual interest in films, theatre, and futuristic application of computers, their relationship was becoming musty and embarrassing. Each of them, separately, passed by that milky pink vase and inquired as to how much it cost. Neither of them found the idea of the vase to be worth $65.
So I'll be reading Iona by Kukimura. In a suburban house with white shingles and black shutters, Iona, a woman of 40, lived with her mother, a woman of 64. The mother depended on her daughter now that she had had emphysema and spent most of her time divided lying in an oxygen tent, surrounded by legions of waiting oxygen drums and being propped up on pillows in the front window, overlooking the garden on display to the neighbors. That Iona, back again with her mother after a 15-year sojourn in a lonely marriage to a man that was wealthy, money amassed through a patented adjustment to a racket wrench, was capable and independent enough to take on the responsibilities of the house for her mother's illness was questionable. But she had taken a mature stand to leave her husband and quit the ruse of love. If she could do that, she could do anything. So now she was home again, planting flowers for her mother with the seeds that her mother had given her. A profusion of colour all over the lawn was what the older lady desired, but Iona threw away all the seeds, but impatience, bachelor's buttons, and sweet William, because these names were meaningful to Iona, who squeezed significance from everything. She went to the shopping mall every day to escape the sound of breathing. In the mall, the music was a cradle, and all the mannequins in the windows wore clothes as bland as puree. She found herself, like the rest of the people there, speaking in hushed tones in reverence to them all, intoxicated by the sheer size and force of the steel and stone and glass, and the endless display of things to buy. But she wasn't very similar to these mall goers at all. She was strong and fierce. Despite the blue tablets of Librium, she took four times a day to quell her feelings of insecurity. Unable to relax, always waiting, wanting new input or streamlined stimuli, she drove around at high speeds in her mother's beige Volare, dreaming about transformation and destruction. Most often, she dreamed of the phoenix, living and burning, repeatedly rising from the flames and rubble of the shopping mall. Wings spread, casting shadows on all of suburbia. When her dreams went flaccid and weren't enough, she thought about meeting a man and how she would do it. One day at the mall, she went into a bar, a place called Libby's Lounge. Her mother had warned her about this place, as if there was something horribly off-colour about it. But Iona knew that her mother had probably never been in a bar in her entire life. It was exactly like any other, dark and carpeted and quiet in the day. Iona expected to meet a man there, and she did. His name was William Way. When they began to talk and drink together in the coolness of the lounge, she knew that finally she had met someone so much like herself that she felt almost as if, miraculously, her DNA double helix had uncoiled to make this man. Here was the man for her, someone who shared her every mood, someone who had been waiting just for her. She brought him back to her home, and they fucked in her bedroom with the background noise of her mother's labored breathing and the oxygen whooshing from the tanks. Whatever similarities that this new couple, Bill and Iona, shared, the fact that Bill had been a Franciscan monk brought them the closest. In the 15 years of abstinence and isolation, with only his pets as companions, he gathered a certain knowledge of the natural world. He stirred her into the initial sexual response by telling her about male kangaroos and of possums who had forked dicks, the females forked vaginas. He told her about Abyssinian bats who have dicks with bristles just like bottle brushes. He told her about the day he had taken a live mouse and carefully cut it open to take a cellular tissue scraping from the heart to see the tiny piece under the microscopic pulsing all by itself. This fact made her see the order of life that before she had only dreamt was true. This monk, he was perfect. They didn't marry, but he moved in and together they buried her mother. Only grudgingly had she relinquished her tenacious grasp on life. They planted tomatoes, corn and sunflowers where all the flowers had been. In the summer, they took his boat to the edge of the falls, and in the autumn, they burned leaves in the front lawn. In winter, they went out on the frozen river to cut holes in the ice and fish. One day, on the ice, the ex-monk fell into one of the holes, and when he finally bobbed up, he was in a cube of ice and dead. And now Iona buried him alone and wanted to leave her body, but didn't have the courage to commit suicide, nor the patience to cox astral travel by meditation. Then she found out that she was pregnant, and there was something else, a third twin perhaps. Within her thinking of all these wonderful uterine thoughts, she was consoled. This really was just the beginning, and she was finally, after all these years, being included into life's mysterious order, where tranquility's sweat, bloodless arms would envelop her and rock her until the end. It goes without saying that one would be surprised to find a woman of 40 with acne. It is so often associated with adolescence. When a woman of 40 gets pregnant for the first time, the hormones go haywire. Iona got pimples. She came to me and I gave her the cure. By the time she was 5 months pregnant, there weren't any pimples. The cure not only cleared her skin, but strengthened her and her baby, who turned out to be a girl, an amazing child. Iona remarried later to a man who was pretty fat, and boy was he a happy man. They had a son a year later, and the husband father was so happy that he laughed so loud he shook the house. He was also a very lucky man to have found Iona.
Gothic Tourism, Cheryl Clark. Myself is a house I'm afraid to enter. Some humility would help break down my gables of ego here in Jersey City, where the stares of recently immigrated East Indians from Guyana, third generation Italians, fourth generation Irish Egyptians taken for Puerto Ricans, post-Castro Cubans who fear being mistaken for Puerto Ricans, and a bar on every corner flashing a neon shamrock, an emblem for no colored need apply. When I need a pack of cigarettes at midnight, mark their hope I'm just passing through. A fat little girl with a wild side hides in my house abandoned for 37 years to the darkness where she licks her lips and sings of her roots deep in North Carolina, somewhere near Hickory. Her people didn't leave on the Trail of Tears, but were marooned in the Great Smokies. Our grandmother spent time in Tulsa, though, and then some in Detroit, then in DC. And for the first time, I hear her sing to me seductively, "You need love, baby. I need love, baby. See me. See me." Myself is a house I'm afraid to enter. Having forsaken those red hills for concrete refined, those rustic ways to cool black. Here in Jersey City, old people are friendly out of fear, and Filipinos attend Mass as steadfastly as Italians and Irish. Home of Lech Walesa's father, my ophthalmologist's uncle, and my ex-lover's husband, a cuckold, and me. Its most recent reluctant immigrant. No Southern hospitality here. If only I had the archaeologist's tool to excavate some connecting marrow under this rehabilitated rubble of yuppies where Africans used to live. And my creepy birds of paradise lose their color in the smog wasting in my window for Manhattan in this perfect apartment we rented from a nice Jewish couple. Not yuppies, but young and professional. After a year of desperate Sundays eating yogurt in a park of bear and buffalo sculptures, suspended in some primordial epic till 1 o'clock and the next appointment. A polite Pole, who renovated his house himself, introduces a beautiful woman as his old lady. I fantasize introducing my beautiful lover as my old lady and saying, we'll share the same bedroom and watching him falter before his fear of AIDS as I ask for a glass of water. You can't drink the water in Jersey City, our landlords warn. Foreigners too, from Brooklyn. I need love, baby. You need love, baby. See me. See me. She sings seductively, playing with her pubic hairs in a dark corner of the house I'm afraid to enter. It's woodwork painted over for decades, like gradations of ego. Pop Life. Siku Sundiata. I'm in this movie, see? Speeding from state to state. I can't make it on the limit, so I break space. Deep in the bass, a line that walks, modulates, and turns under the influence of whatever is the recommended daily allowance. A slow drag moon speaks to the water in my brain. Put away your romance. You ain't no lover. You ain't no killer. You are a lover. And a long establishing shot, the opposition of shadow and substance. Suddenly things be exactly what they appear to be. Monday is the day after Friday. Nothing's funny. A true hero would laugh about pissing in the wind. The next shot doesn't let the murderer out. Proud to say he's still right here with me. A joker appears on stage in a white spot, like a game show. Name one style, he says, from the year 1984. Or, well, do you remember that picture of them in Le Monde? The wife kissing the president in the mouth. Tongue and spit, that sort of thing. She was right about Europe. She was right about the moon. And then in the convention hall, under that hard light, she was waving her hand, wrist and arm at his huge face in the video monitor as the zipper waited in the hotel room with his pal. The mind screen located the first family in a place at that moment called The Nation. This is the American living room, his buddy whispered. She's waving at you, Chief. The Chief nudges him, points at the screen and nudges him again, shifting mentally like he does from foot to foot, happy to recall how it's all done with mirrors. The First Lady signal mushrooms into a radiant but silent smile. He was grinning and waving back the way you do with babies and animals. You could really see his boyish charm. Speeding from state to state, I can't make it on the limit, so I break space. Telephone poles frame the land according to how the neon runs, freeze dries, adds body. The future promise zooms by various exits, product, glowing in its face, crystal moons for lovers who live inside of pop tunes, a national breakfast special, foreign auto parts, a burger, a steak, a seafood combination. Movie house supermarket, dry cleaners, wreckage haulers, 16-wheelers, the X-ray and Xerox generation, sing-along rock and roll, and the radio background of its inheritance spinning like a Vegas, tracking the overused night. And here stands the blue collar with a torso inside, acetylene fire oozing from the sleeve. There stands tomorrow, an ex-famous athlete grinning, stuck inside a revolving door, and behind him the casino, like a birthday cake with leaky candles. A line of scrimmage. The flag blossoms in a crush of uniforms, hot dogs, and beer. The anthem roars from house to house, the foot pedal slams like the heart of the green giant against the kick drum in common time. Cymbals splash, crash, tis of thee, tis of thee, tis of thee.
By Mary Kelly from 1990. A total appeared in digital red, and a voice next to it issued an ultimatum. Cash or charge? She opened a checkbook, leafing quickly past the tried-to-cut-down, no-use panic of the balances and onto the serene stupidity of those blank pages, tenderly illustrated, promising everything. The 16th day of the 10th month of a very bad year, she began spoiling the future of a perfect seascape. 110, and how could they eat so much 88, she wrote reluctantly over the pale seagulls that, frightened by the calamitous motion of a pen, flew away to the safety of the bank's logo in the left-hand corner. She signed the name at the vanishing point of that replete horizon, but without conviction. Things must change, she thought. The children were materialistic, wanted everything, a boat, a car. They watched too much TV. She filled the plastic carrier bags and speculated on the savings she would make by using them to line the trash bin. Being thrifty, she felt more optimistic. Her receipt became a confirmation of her wisdom. Its purple abbreviations, a miracle, 7 days, 21 meals, and an hour of agonized decision making digested and spewed out in 2 postmodern seconds by a diligent computer. More than that, there was the thrill of walking out with all that food. And then, a modicum of ecstasy, she'd make them something wonderful to eat. What's the fastest way to make a million? Invent something. Something useful like inflatable soles for orthopedic shoes, or a soundproof tent to cover the TV and the kids. Maybe you should target a specific group. That's it. Essence of Irish stew, made in Dublin and exported to New Jersey. Say, what about a white trash restaurant? You could serve opossum, no? Okay, something for the masses then, like a square football? 9 o'clock, the restaurant was full, but they were seated promptly. Things had changed. He was successful, she enjoyed it, life was good. That thought granted her a smile. I never took it back abruptly. She remembered when they had no money, and 4 small children to sustain, to manage in this dangerous and expensive city. At a table near them, someone tried to calm a child of 2 or 3, she could not be sure, so long since then, could not recall just what distinguishes each stage. She watched, not able to imagine how she did it. Cook, clean, stevedore her precious cargo to the school steps every day. Her own work too. Not that she did it badly, simply that she had not done it. Had postponed her life till later. Later being now, when they were grown up and she was exhausted. Still, all were fine except for one who was troubled, so defiant. Why? 3 out of 4, not bad, their father joked, and ordered fish. No salt or butter, she reminded him. I still need you, see? He said. She ordered kale and fennel, lightly steamed. No condiments, No consolation. He was gone. Now everything would be her way. First, the newspapers, fossilizing in a precious cupboard space. She'd thrown them out. Then the receipts, itineraries, tickets, lists. A little mound of crumpled past that grew, insatiable and fungus-like, around her telephone, devouring two volumes of the shorter Oxford Dictionary and a Franklin spelling ace. She'd put an end to that. Finally, but most emphatically, she plotted to clean the bathroom, to remove the cello ref and cross it on the toilet bowl, the gliding spray inside the seat, outside the tank too, for that matter, and when she looked more closely on the wall behind it all the way up to the light switch. She wondered what evolutionary lapse had shaped such an improbable, undefined anatomy and felt annoyed. She was alone. At last she could open all the windows without arbitration and embrace the cold, emancipated air. She was surrounded by nothing, nothing but an arc of abstinent light and the smell of palest blue. The house effused a canny silence and the bathroom was so clean, so clean. What's the fastest way to make a million? Real estate, of course. Buy a small building, preferably in an up-and-coming neighborhood, convert it into apartments, and use the rent income to pay the mortgage. Then, with the first building as equity, buy a second, convert, rent, buy again, and so on. Simple. Well, except for the fact that you'd have to save to borrow enough money for the initial investment. Three gables and a country porch just visible beyond a cast iron gate. It could be perfect. She imagined tidy evergreens and red azaleas against a brick facade. Instead, she found a thicket of dense bramble, a few wild poppies, and an insipid cupid pissing in a seashell. That would have to go. She sealed its fate and carried on. A double door, stained glass, she turned the key. It could be perfect with a little work. Replastered paint, removed the carpet and the hideous drapes. She planned, envisioning a floor of polished oak, a tasteful rug, an open fire. Perhaps it's Christmas. Yes, a tree, clear light, of course, with berry clusters, cabbage roses, ribbons, raffia and lace. He chopped the wood and she'd prepared a goose. Where was the kitchen anyway? She found it. Much too small. An off extension, possibly. A walk-in pantry, but too dark. She'd had a skylight, then a granite counter, porcelain sink, refrigerator, freezer, agar range. Above her would be here by a window. She looked out, a partial view obstructed by the freeway, but the lot was large enough to have a pool. Gazebo, even perfect. Scalloped tiles, it could be perfect. Well, it could be. Could be perfect if... South on 15, East on 8, exit off ramp 94, Potiroro, Campo, Rekumba, then nothing. The foothills grounded down to a solemn flatness. She looked at the map. Turn left, 6 miles at the reservoir, windmill to the right, slow down. There it was. Huge Gorkin hacienda surrounded by a metal fence, snarling barbed wire at the rim. I looked abused, once elegant, veranda. Ornate tiles, now weathered, cracked. Imagining the Spanish with the clavichords and lacquered armoires, she ported her stereo and her answering machine to the entrance of the property. It belonged to her. 4,000 feet of open space for next to nothing. Unthinkable back in the city where she would be, but at last she could see several paintings at the same time and afford to have assistance. They would be grateful for work here. Although she had been told to keep a gun, not to shoot, of course. To show them she meant business. Business, yes. She would do business. She would be discovered, world woman painter of, well, 48. No child prodigy, but ambitious nevertheless. She would entertain in her capacious monument, vaulted ceiling and expansive walls, high windows, ample frames, each painted white. the table laid, her ivory candles would disperse their shrewd titanium light, and guests, all wearing black, would chant, "Great space, great space." What's the fastest way to make a million? Crime. Yeah, that's the only way. Should be stylish, though, let's see. You could make a perfect replica of a nighttime deposit box, graft it carefully onto the bank's facade, and then remove it several hours later with substantial contents. Beautiful, what do you think?
Et on va finir avec un enregistrement de Kathy Acker pour les débuts du les vernissages, the lancement of Top Stories in 1983.
Description of photograph number two. President Ronald Reagan. Description of photograph number one. Most of the people I now know who used to go to clubs such as CBGB's in the mud every night, this year are staying in their homes all the time. When they talk to their friends, they do so over the phone. Description of photograph number two. President Ronald Reagan. Everyone knows he's a murderer. He killed John F. Kennedy. Mayor Koch, the man in this picture. This is Mayor Koch speaking. Ronald Reagan was one of the main perpetrators of the murder of JFK, but I don't care because he helped my career a great deal. In fact, I can say he made me. Survival has to be more important to me than moral considerations because, like most people in this city, which has been going under due to our federal government shuffling off of its financial responsibilities to us, I find economic survival tenuous. I have to do exactly what I have to do, and I have to be clever to survive. I think I'm a good mayor for New York. The city's an extension of me. In order to keep both of us going, I must expand both of our power. I'm doing this in two ways. We all know, we New Yorkers are not naive, that at its top levels, economic power or money and general power are, shall I say, inextricably joined. I'm maintaining our financial power by increasing our control. I'm either killing the Puerto Ricans or making sure they're forced to live far from New York, somewhere in the nitrogen pits of New Jersey. For this reason alone, I'm the most successful mayor New York's ever had.
Merci beaucoup, Luca. Aussi, je veux dire merci à Thomas Rayon pour les recherches et merci à toutes et tous. Merci.